Good morning. Good to see you all. I hope you are doing well. But whether you are doing well or not, I'm really glad that you are here. And I'm just going to leap into my topic for today, which is Yiqui's Chan Meditation. Yiqui is a 17th century Chinese Chan nun, Chan being the Chinese pronunciation of the word Zen, and her poem being just about what it's like to meditate. So some of you may have heard a little bit about Yiqui before, because I don't stop talking about her. I think my last talk may have been about Yiqui's poems. And this will not be like a comprehensive, the story of Yiqui, or even the story of this poem. I'm just going to kind of let us play around in the realm of her teachings. And but today, as I was reading Yiqui's biography, the thing that struck me was that she was widowed at 23. So Yiqui was from a very educated family. Her grandfather was a judge, and her father was a scholar painter. There's a whole, in China, there's thing called the literati tradition. So there's a deep appreciation for the arts. When you wanted a government job, you had to pass a poetry exam. Wow! Times change. I mean, actually, that may still be true in China. I don't know. Anyway. But yes, so she married, I don't know when. Yeah, but apparently the marriage was pretty good, and then her husband died when she was 23. And then she just decided what she wanted to do was practice. So we don't have a lot of records of what exactly was going on for her at the time, but my guess is it wasn't easy. I don't know, but usually when we lose someone, it's hard. So I've seen this quite a bit. People end up doing this thing that we're doing because things are pretty hard. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there are some people in here who are here for that reason. Well, certainly that's what brought me. But it's not universal. It's important to say it's not universal, because I'll meet people for Dokusan during retreat, and you know, you'll sit there and someone will come in and they'll just be, just be crying. Ah, wow. And someone else will be talking about this pervasive, amorphous fear that goes with them everywhere they go. People will talk about this enormous shame. And then other people will be like, oh, I'm doing pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm just kind of interested in, you know, how does it all work? And that's okay. It's okay. You have your own reasons to be here. You probably know a tiny, tiny, infinitesimal fraction of what they are, because that's how we are. Most of our behavior is motivated by unknown things. But whatever it is that you know, that's valid. It's valid. You get to have your own path, your own motivation, and you can use being here as a way to deepen your understanding of what that is. What is true to you? What do you want to do with your life? But Yiqui, on the death of her husband, seems to have decided what she wanted to do with her life was completely immerse herself in Chan Zen practice. And that's what we have evidence of and have been left with this beautiful body of teaching. So today I want to focus on a particular poem of Yiqui's, which is called Chan Meditation. And one of my favorite ways of engaging with poetry is through chanting. If you haven't tried chanting, you're in for a treat, because you'll get to experience what your mind and your body do when you chant. And it might be very wonderful. They might be like, ah, I'm making sounds in a room full of people, and it's resonant, and it's beautiful. Or you might think, oh my God, what's happening here? And you get to experience that, whatever it is for you. How wondrous. So I do not do this in order to put people who don't like chanting into the cauldron of their own aversion. But, you know, sometimes jumping into the cauldron of aversion is a ground for amazing learning and liberation. So however you respond to this, that's cool. You can just check it out. I will pass these around. So chanting in the Zen style is very simple. Basically, we chant on a single pitch with the, usually men's voices tend to be one octave lower than women's. And if you haven't tried it, I think you'll be able to figure out what's going on pretty quickly. Oh, I forgot to keep one for myself. Thank you. Thank you for letting me be myself. So, because this is kind of a root ritual practice of ours, you know, you don't get to chant very much if you come on Sunday, but if you come for morning zazen, Monday through Saturday, you can begin to feel what happens when you take the literature of this tradition into your body and your voice with other people, and I can't recommend it enough. Anyway, when we chant in the traditional Zen practice, we have three fingers out of the document and two in the thumb and the pinky in. And you might think, how particular, but let me tell you this. Every ritual is bizarre from the outside. What happens if someone from a small town in southern India goes to a Minnesota Gophers football game? They're going to say, this is bizarre. Chanting, yelling, ritual intoxication. What is this? So anyway, let us chant together. I'll chant the title alone. Chan meditation. Once the layered gates are shattered, any place is a place of tranquility. Once the mind becomes unattached to things, all things become pure. In moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of the pine tree, watching as the toad in the moon slowly rises to hover in the east. When one freely speaks of the Dharma, the heavenly flowers fall. When one deliberates and debates, one is only confused by things. With the right opportunity and good fortune, nothing is impossible. Knocking on emptiness, extracting the marrow, becomes a way of life. How wonderfully sublime to discuss mysteries layered like clouds. It is truly rare to meet someone who can be called a kindred soul. The red stove blazes forth with extraordinary determination, as if it possessed the karmic power to turn the Dharma wheel. This toiling life, disordered and confused by lust, greed, and anger. But when the mind flower suddenly opens, the world becomes spring. Melting snow to boil water for tea, I while away the entire day, feeling inside as vast and expansive as the icy cold moon above. A tiny boat in the moonlight stirs up foam flowers on the water. Blossoming water lilies send across their fragrances in the dark. Hearing, seeing, knowledge, and consciousness are all one Dharma. Now this nun can afford to be lazy and let her hair grow long. I invite you to just close your eyes for a minute and see if any line, you probably won't remember the actual line exactly, but any line or theme, well, more like a line or a word or a phrase from the poem, just is resonating or pops back into your memory. So like I say, you might not remember the actual line, but you'd be like, oh, there was that thing that was, just let that float up, if something floats up. And if nothing floats up, that's fine. And then you can just have a look at the piece of paper and see if you can locate, if there was a line that floated up, locate it. And if you have located something, you can, I invite you to just read it out loud in a voice that we all can hear.
The red stone blazes forth with an extraordinary determination.
Melting snow to boil water for tea, I while away the entire day, feeling inside as vast and expansive as the icy cold moon above.
Latching on emptiness, extracting the marrow becomes a way of life. Watching as the toad in the moon slowly rises to hover in the east.
Mysteries layered like clouds.
A tiny boat in the moonlight stirs up foam flowers on the water, blossoming water lilies send across their fragrances in the dark.
But when the mind flower suddenly opens, the world becomes spring.
Now this nun can afford to be lazy and let her hair grow long.
When one deliberates and debates, one is only confused by things.
All right, well, that seems pretty good. We could probably go on a little longer, but maybe I'll go on in a different way. So, like I say, I'm not going to say, like, well, this is the general theme of the poem, in part because I've talked about this poem here multiple times, including just a few months ago. So I just let the marrow reveal itself. So we'll just see what was kind of striking me as I prepared this week. First, I'd like to just call your attention to this line, "In moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of the pine tree." And in case you don't notice, this theme of sort of relaxing and just settling into things is pretty strong in this poem. "In moments of leisure, I sit upright in the shade of the pine tree." So, first, I'd just like to say, what a wonderful thing to do in moments of leisure. Like, she watches the moon rise. The moon doesn't go very fast. I don't know if you've ever watched the moon rise, but it's not, like, in a hurry. And so, you know, you might be like, oh, yeah, it's the moon. That's good. I got that. What's next? But to actually watch it rise, I mean, she's got to be pretty just there, right? So in moments of leisure, how often, like if you're like, oh, I don't have a task right now, do you just like sit and just let everything be? It's just like, not doing anything. My guess is not very often. Not very often. We might sit and think. We might sit and scroll through pages of things on the internet. We might watch TV. TV's gotten really good now, right? Used to be not as good. Now TV's good. So it's like, oh, I watch some TV, read a book, just fritter from thing to thing. Oh, it's so easy. It's so compelling. Why do we do it? And yet, it's so wonderful if you can let yourself really, in that moment of leisure, just sit. You don't have to do like, I'm just sitting. Now I'm just sitting. How can just sitting be fancy? It's just sitting. It's not a big deal. You don't have to wait for Zazen to practice realization. When I see this, where we're really going to see this, I bet, and where I've seen it many times, is during Rohatsu session, which is coming up in about 3 weeks. So that's our biggest retreat of the year. It's about a week long. And it's pretty rigorous for most people. But if you go, it's many times I've gone onto the porch during Rohatsu during a break, and the palpable sense of embodied stillness is overwhelming. People are just sitting there, and you can, I mean, who knows what's going on in people's minds, but you can feel that they're just there, and they're just like watching snowflakes. Watching a snowflake, or whatever it is. Wow. And it matters. To touch this kind of peace really matters. We are heavily conditioned to believe that it doesn't. But it really matters. People need to encounter peace. What did Black Elk once say? There can never be peace between nations until there is peace in the hearts of men. And I will add, women. So, on the other hand, Zazen, you know, Zazen is also what she's describing here, I think, pretty clearly, because to sit at the roots of a tree is the classic trope or way of describing practicing meditation in many, many Buddhist texts. So, in the early Pali Canon, Buddha's always like, go to the roots of trees, which is maybe because that's where he realized enlightenment. I don't know. But anyway, also, trees are really good. They're really good at showing you a way of being that you're not used to. They're just not running around. J.R.R. Tolkien had his faults, but the Ents, he was pointing toward something. So, she's describing like, oh, it's morning Zazen time, sitting at the root of a tree. And she describes it as a moment of leisure. Wow. So I just would like everyone to remember this, that Zazen can be a moment of leisure. Because the thing is, sometimes Zazen is really hard for people, or they say it's hard, and your experience is always valid. And so then because people think it's hard, it's really important to say, oh, that's okay. You know, sometimes it's hard. That's important. That's part of the process. And to affirm that, because otherwise people will go, I'm doing it wrong. I got to leave, or something's wrong with me, or something's wrong, blah, blah, blah. So I have to keep reminding people, yes, sometimes it's hard, and we can be with that, and it's powerful. And yet, we talk about it so much, then we might forget that, as Dogen says, Zazen is not meditation practice. It is simply the Dharma gate of joyful repose and ease. He's saying the gate that is being presented to you as a way of practice is total joy and repose. That's all I'm asking you to do, is just come into this room and do joy and repose. No problem. So don't forget, I mean, that can happen too. Because the way we frame we do always constructs what we experience. It's always going to be true. So if you don't experience this joy and repose, that's fine. That's real. That's you. That's valuable. But it's okay for it to just be total leisure. Just like bodily sensations, sounds, sights, feelings, thoughts, smells. And if you come to Rohatsu, there'll be tastes. Because you get food. So, going on here at one point, she says, this toiling life disordered and confused by lust, greed, and anger. And, if you're like me, that probably I have some sense of what that's about. But it's just worth knowing that we hold on, we actively, both consciously and unconsciously, hold on to our lust, greed, and anger. So, desire is kind of exciting, you know? It's like I'm planning a vacation with my wife, and I kind of get into enjoying the desire of getting the thing, and it feels good, it's cool, that's all right. And of course, anger, and that, consummation of desire is exciting for people. And anger Also, people like, you might think you don't like anger, but on some level, most of us do. And some level, some of us like it a lot. Because when we're angry, we can feel righteous. We can feel power in our bodies. So when you experience anger, your body floods itself with all this stuff that is like, ah, it's trying to feel power. Sometimes it feels powerless, but it's like in this struggle. But it's, oh, but we kind of want it, you know. You're like, oh, those stupid bad people over there. You can feel kind of good, righteous. So we hold on to this stuff. We take pleasure as human beings in desire, lust, and anger. I think it's pretty clear. But here's the thing. The pleasure of those things, in my experience, isn't even close to the bliss of putting them down. It's not even close. It's hard to believe how much you can put them down and what can open up for you when you do. And the third noble truth is very explicit, is that the end of suffering is when you actively let go of craving. You have to let it go. We hold on to it, but we can put it down. And then there's something way more beautiful and expansive. Buddha talks about this very specifically in the Pali Canon of being like, oh, I kind of like this desire. It's pretty good. And then he's like, but it's also I keep looping on it, and then it's unsatisfied, and that's like, back and forth. It just doesn't quite work. And he's like, isn't there something beyond this? Some kind of bliss beyond this? And his teaching is, yes, there is. There is a bliss beyond getting something for yourself. Gaining anything, controlling anything, making yourself into something that you're not. A bliss beyond all of that. Of just bodily sensations, sounds, sights, smells, feelings, thoughts, at leisure, right here. So, later on, Yi Kui talks about the red stove blazes forth with an extraordinary determination. She also talks about feeling inside as vast and expansive as the icy cold moon above. So we have this cold and this heat. So she's not experiencing some bliss that is the absence of cold and heat. I don't know if you've ever lived somewhere that's heated by a wood stove, but it is not like a thermostat. I'll tell you what. I mean, it's wonderful. But I remember one time being in a hermitage, and I was like, oh, it's so fun. I have my wood stove, and it's really cold outside, but I could stay warm, and it's like time to go to bed. So I put a bunch of wood in there, and I closed it, and I went to sleep. And I woke up, and it was like 115 degrees. The life she chose was not one that was insulated from suffering. It was one that was directly going towards it. This has been the model for a long time. Not like trying to get suffering, but trying not to just constantly make a world where you can be like, I'm safe in my little place. Everything's cool. She was deeply engaged with her community. She was the abbess of Crouching Lion Convent for a long time, even though she didn't seem to much like it. In the other book about her, she wants to go to her smaller hermitage that she founded, but her teacher's place is really big, and they're like, we need you. And she goes, and it's hard. It's hard running a big thing and being engaged with all these constituencies in her community, but she did it. So Yi Kui was, this going where there's cold and heat, going where it's like not all managed for our comfort, I think it's really good. That is one of the reasons that I lead wilderness retreats. I go on wilderness retreats, and lead people on them, because you can go somewhere and it's like you're just not in control at all. You know, it's raining, you're going to get cold. So then we just focus on not dying. And we don't do things that are super dangerous. But, you know, you got to take care of your stuff. You got to take care of your stuff. But we expose ourselves to the environment more completely. And what happens, I think this has been absolute universal, everyone I've done one of these with. I mean, the joy that they are manifesting when they come out of that container. And during it, you know, people are like, ah, my feet hurt, and it's cold as hell, and it's too hot. And then joyfulness. Real joy is not going to come from just getting what you want. That's too small. It's too small. So anyway, Yiqui was, so as I said earlier, she came from a very prominent family. Her grandfather was a judge. We don't know that much about her, but we know her grandfather was a judge and her father was a prominent scholar and painter. And then she was like at an early age already like a accomplished poet and painter. So very educated, accomplished, fairly wealthy family. And what she chose to do was to go into the convent, which was not a wealthy place. You know, it's like, oh, we got food. We go around the community and we get offerings for food and we have a garden. Pretty simple life. And this has been the way for a long time, you know. I mean, when Mahapajapati was asking Buddha to let women into the Sangha, this is a long story. His resistance is not good. But anyway, in that process, what she did, he said no. She and all the people who were with her, they just shaved their heads and started living homelessly because that's what they were asking to be able to do. They gave up their homes, they gave up all their personal possessions, and they shaved their heads because that's what they were asking to be allowed to do. You mean, that's bizarre. But it has been fundamental to this tradition for a long time. Why do you do that? Not to like be better than people or to expunge your karma, because that's what will let you be happiest. It's very radical. And, you know, around Western convert communities is not a popular topic. And you may wish I wasn't talking about it. Because we are so powerfully conditioned to believe that acquiring and having material goods will promote our happiness. So powerfully conditioned that I can't begin to see outside of it myself. And yet, this counter message is powerful. That the invitation to liberation will be in just letting it all go. I need that challenge. So anyway, it's a lot. Then, another thing to say is, so, you know, Buddha was like its prince, and he gave up all his possessions to go into this path and then invited other people into that. And within the Chinese monastic system, people, you know, people who are very privileged, like Yiqui, would go into that system, but it was also a lot of the people there were people who were just very poor. So families who had very few resources, they would just be like, oh, this is a place where you can have shelter, you can have food, you can have community, and you can have resources to work out your liberation. Pretty good. Pretty good. And people would just come together and make that container together. And they've been doing that for a long time, which I think is pretty inspiring. Now, it's worth noting, in case it's not apparent, that, you know, China, they have snow, it's cold. You know, the homeless tradition in India was in a place where you can just live outside and it's pretty good. Rains, you go sleep under a tree. Not bad. But in northern China, you need a roof. And definitely in Minnesota, you need a roof. And here's the thing. There's a lot of people that don't have one. So although the Buddha, from early on and throughout this tradition, there's been this tradition of abandoning home and letting go of things, in many, many sutras, he talks about the importance of helping people find food, shelter, and medicine. Then community, and then Dharma. There are lots of sutras on this subject. So it's just good to know that we have an opportunity to manifest this where we live. So we live in a city where there are a lot of homeless people. And people are doing a lot of wonderful things. Actually, the city just, with a lot of people came together to get the city to pledge $18 million this week to build extremely low-income housing, which is really cool. It's a lot of work by a lot of people, and there's more to do. So people are working on this. You know, it's kind of weird to call it out because Tim's just sitting here, but you may or may not know that Tim, our one of our guiding teachers here, for 12 years or so was both the guiding teacher here and the CEO of People Incorporated, which has provided housing and lots of other kinds of service for many, many people who are experiencing chronic mental illness. So, you know, people can do stuff. It's cool. You may or may not remember that what was called the Wall of Forgotten Indians, which is the large homeless encampment that was on Hiawatha Avenue. It was about 200 people living there in tents a year or two ago. And it was a dangerous place. People died there. And there was an enormous effort by the community. The MUID, which is the Metropolitan Urban Indian
Directors,
thank you, which is a group of a coalition of indigenous-led group partnered with the city and with private organizations, and really they helped move people out of that camp and into better situations. But the thing is, this situation persists, and it's just really worth remembering for all of us that homelessness is particularly manifested in the indigenous population. And we're sitting here right at the north edge of what was Hayata Atunwe, which was a very long-standing Dakota village along Bademakaska. So here we are in this place, this beautiful thing. I hope you're doing well. And I think if we keep remembering that we're connected to all these things, it can affect transformation. It can affect transformation. And I think we can do better. So, in here, she says, when one freely speaks of the Dharma, the heavenly flowers fall. When one deliberates and debates, one is only confused by things. Now, I think debate is a valid and useful mode of discourse. And deliberation is sometimes helpful. I got to sit around and be like, well, what am I going to do? You know, maybe it doesn't seem very zen, but sometimes you got to chew on something. I think that's just the way it is. I would love to be perfectly intuitive, but that sounds a little dangerous. If I was always like, well, I thought of it, it must be right. So a little deliberation can be good. But what I'm thinking here today about this idea of freely speaking the Dharma is that to freely speak the Dharma is to speak in a way that is informed by awareness that everything is interdependent. So once we start deliberating and debating, we begin to collapse in on believing the solidity of all the little things that we think are separate. And we begin to lose sight that our speech and everything else are based in an inescapable network of mutuality. So I'm just going to do one more of these things here. You can tell me if I'm telling this story wrong, Tim. So, you know, Tim used to talk, he would talk about like having to lobby, you know, and it's like you're deliberating and debating, I think. How do you make that into freely sharing the Dharma? That's a challenge. In an environment where the model is deliberation and debate, how can you go into that place and manifest something that is about realizing connection for everyone's liberation? That's a challenge. But I remember being really moved by this story of People Incorporated, like we're trying to get funding at the Capitol, and there was a big hearing, and they just brought a bunch of people who had lived in their facilities. So people who had been homeless, who had chronic and persistent mental illness, and who had received services from People Incorporated, and they just had them come up and talk about their experience. And they were just real. I got to say, like, thinking about this, I don't know what it's like, but I would be scared. I'm like really into public speaking, you might detect. If you send me to the legislature to give a speech to a whole bunch of people, I'd be like, oh, well, I'm kind of nervous. Imagine if you were a person who has been like ignored and pushed down and marginalized for so long to have the courage to stand up and really speak about the pain and the kindness and your own growth. Wow! And apparently, it was pretty effective. It was pretty effective. Cornel West, if you don't know Cornel West, please look up Cornel West. A person who shares my enormous interest in liberating everyone from suffering. But anyway, Cornel West once wrote, "You must let suffering speak if you want to hear the truth." You must let suffering speak if you want to hear the truth. The truth is that everything is already complete the way it is, and yet also the truth is that we suffer. We can't, if we try and hide from it, if we try and find a liberation that is hiding from it, it will never really be free. But we can do this both within our communities, like make room for ourselves to be real. We can do it outside of this building and open our ears and actively promote the voices of people who need to share their suffering. And then when you sit zazen, even though it's total ledger, you might find, oh my goodness, there's a lot of suffering in me that needs to speak. And you can listen. You can just be there for it. This is a way towards the truth. And it doesn't mean the truth is suffering. It just means that this vast expanse of what life can be opens up when we make room for that voice to be heard. Thank you. So, I'm going to invite people to speak. I like questions, comments, anything. Yeah.
I know this is probably translated from Chinese into English, so it's always an imperfect representation, but is there a fundamental difference for how they would translate lust versus desire? Like, anger is kind of one of those separate words that's pretty intuitive to hang on to, but you look at it in the perspective of lust versus desire. I kind of was like, well, is it splitting hairs? Is it the same thing? Are there different... What's the fundamental difference?
It's a good question. So it's funny because I don't know Chinese, but I know like tiny. And those are the three characters I looked at. That's interesting. Generally speaking, the root from the, when you take it from the Sanskrit, so the basic model is the drivers of suffering are, you could say, desire, aversion, and delusion, or sometimes we say greed, hatred, and illusion, or it could be lust, hatred, and so those translations are all fairly accurate, but I think that desire is the best for that very root thing, because then when you begin to unpack all the related texts, it encompasses such a huge range of things that you could desire. So I don't know the Chinese and what she uses here. What's most distinctive to me is she doesn't talk about delusion in that, but she uses lust, greed, and anger. Yeah. So anyway, generally speaking, I don't know this poem, but for most Dharma teaching, I recommend holding the most broad and neutral definitions of these terms that you can. Desire, aversion, and delusion, I think are pretty good. Because then you can see it's like desire can be pretty small and still causes you a little angst. It can also be very big and cause you some angst.
Other language that I read about, toad in the moon.
You guys are really challenging me on my scholarly acumen here. So oddly, in Chinese folklore, usually it's a rabbit in the moon. The toad in the moon is virulently... I have been able to find almost no references, so I don't know what her deal is. She may just be a very imaginative person. But anyway, I've done some research into that and not gotten very far. So, sorry. There's a whole panoply of folklore around the rabbit, though. Yes?
On a different note, I want to say your discussion of getting caught by possessions, I think, while uncomfortable, is very useful, and I'm glad you say it, and thank you. And when I examine that myself, one of the sort of edges that seems interesting to me is the possession of tools of maybe creativity, and I see that in the sense of sort of traditional Western creativity, you know, sculpture, painting, all that sort of thing. And I know you are a rather accomplished musician. I wonder if you've maybe explored that same edge, and I'd like you to say something about it.
Yeah. Well, the truth is I just have a personal... I think I'm less interested in physical objects than a lot of people, and that's not because like I'm... It's just like a tendency. I'm very acquisitive with ideas, so I go there. So yeah, I have some guitars, but yeah, I bought a guitar a few years ago. It was the first one I bought in about 15 years, which when I go to my tax person, I do my taxes and I'm a musician, so my tax stuff, he's always like, you left your equipment list off. And I'm like, well, I didn't buy any. And he's like, what? Because like most of his clients, they're just people who are trying to justify buying tons of stuff. Anyway, so, but that's not really what I want to talk about. I want to talk a little bit more broadly about this. I want to say something about what bringing to mind the fact that Buddhism teaches that letting go of stuff can make us be happier. If you just try and sort of leap into it or you shame yourself with it, it's not going to help. But I think if we keep taking the message in and just kind of look at how we're living, it can affect change. I think this is generally the process I recommend with everything. Let things that are like, oh, I don't really want to do it, you just be like, okay, yeah. But you just like hang out with it. And you'll see changes happen. So if we just get an ideology and try and like force ourselves into a box, it's not going to help. But we can keep just kind of like letting these little, it's like a little grist. And then we can find a pearl. Yeah. Yes.
Thanks for sharing the poem. It's really interesting and beautiful. I had a question about the red stove. Reminds me, I think I've heard red stove or red furnace as a metaphor somewhere. And I just don't remember. Wondered if anyone else has heard that about you know, your being and how it gets. I think I remember the context of being maybe your mind and it being, you know, just
proliferating.
Yeah. Working really hard, like glowing red.
I don't know. The only thing that comes to mind is the old, monks. They're like, you're just shoveling coal into the, when you feed them, you're just shoveling coal into their mouth for their practice. So they're like little fiery stoves of practice. You come in and get your meal, and then there's some energy and some heat. But I don't have any access to whatever literature is coming to your mind. But she's also making friends with an inanimate object. Everything can be your friend. Everything. We practice with your cushion. When you sit down, we bow. Well, we don't on Sundays, but when you come here during traditional practice, we bow to the cushion because we can learn to care. That when something presents itself to consciousness, it can always be a beautiful relationship. Every time. Okay, I think that's good. Thank you.